Hey, Alex.
Elliot, how's it going?
Good. That's good. So, yeah, remind us.
Yeah, well.
Where are we?
Well, we're here for the polls, but for our new listeners, we actually have three streams within this kind of main podcast. So what you're listening to right now is called The Polls, where Ellie and I talk about all things going on in the industry, from technology acquisition to other really cool news happening within our kind of legal tech world, legal operations world. We have another stream called Talking Tech, where Ellie and I talk to CEOs, CTOs, and other various people from legal technology companies. We talk about their product. We talk about the use cases, awesome conversations. And then we obviously have our headline part of the podcast where we interview thought leaders like Mary Carroll last week and Mick Sheehy a few weeks ago. So just to give everyone a bit of an update on how our streams are going.
Great update, Alex. Okay, so this is The Pulse, all about kind of news and current stuff in the legal tech and legal ops space. Before we get into that, this episode is sponsored by Ironclad. We will have an interview with Ironclad's CEO, Jason Bamig, coming up in about a week or so, and that's going to be on the Talking Tech stream. Now, Ironclad is a CLM tool, a contract lifecycle management tool that is, and I quote, the world's most advanced CLM software. We expect that the episode with Jason is going to be a great chat. There's a whole bunch of things I want to ask him. So definitely keep an eye out for that episode, which should be up in the next week or so. Alex, you know, take us in. What's the first item we've got here?
Yeah, news, look, we've got three items, three points we want to talk about today. One is largest legal tech advisory team is formed. So, interesting, this as with most things I come across, it was going through my LinkedIn and I saw that claim. And I was like, okay, that's really interesting. But there is a consulting company, HBR, which is a consulting company in the US that I'm not super familiar with, but apparently a fairly big players in this space. And they've just made a significant investment into kind of building out their legal tech consulting. In fact, I saw, and you'll probably talk about this more, Elliot, but I saw a quote where they're looking to bring on 100 legal tech consultants a year. That's huge.
On a base of 700. So what is that as a percentage? 15-ish percent, I think, per year.
I know. Yeah. It's insane. And I'm thinking about kind of how many technology consultants there are in Australia right now, or even just how many technology consultants there are in the US. I mean, I don't have a number. But that to me seems like quite a large consulting group of people. And I'm thinking, like, how big's the market? Obviously I think it's from a bias, but huge, but I don't know. That just seems like a large number. I don't know. What do you think, Elliot?
Yeah, well, we've sort of talked about this before, haven't we? Because, you know, we chatted about the news that Deloitte had acquired or hired a bunch of people from, I think it was from Elevate, might have been late last year. Yeah, I think it was late last year, to build a significant legal advisory consulting business and also build out a managed services business. And there's a bunch of other players in the space that we don't need to go into again. But certainly, you know, it's becoming large in terms of numbers. And I agree with you. It kind of feels like, well, what is the size of that market and can it actually support that quantum of people? One thing it's worth noting is that this is described as building the largest legal tech advisory team. So it's not the sort of more generalist legal ops. And this does seem to be more focused on technology and related services. And like you, I don't know a lot about HBR or Kino Cozy, I think they're called. But both of them do seem to be focused on that tech space. And so, for example, as far as I can tell, HBR focuses on a sort of a management consulting aimed at legal departments, as well as managed services, as well as software for law firms. And Kino Cozy seems to be best known in the kind of help desk outsourcing segment and IT services for law firms. So if what you're building or if what they're building here is an advisory and a services and consulting business focused on helping law firms to outsource their kind of back of house activities, you know, all the kind of IT stuff, all the cloud services, probably their finance functions, perhaps their EAs, perhaps their printers and all that kind of stuff. You know, I can see that actually being a pretty huge market when you think about the scale of the market in places like the US and the UK and Asia generally. So yeah, I can see that being a big space. You know, does that justify thousands of people working in the space? It's hard to know, but certainly you've got well, probably hundreds of thousands of lawyers working worldwide. So, yeah, I can see it. I mean, look, one thing I'll just mention here is that I did think there was a really interesting quote in the article that you sent me, which we'll put in the show notes, in the Legal Technology publication by Chris Petrini-Polly, I think his name is. He is the executive chairman of HBR. And I'll just read a little part of the quote here. We believe that technology is going to shape all legal practices. The flavor of that you can argue about, but whether the Am Law 100 will be impacted is not a debate, and that applies to corporate legal departments too. Law schools need to be thoughtful about how they are training their people, and we're looking at the whole ecosystem. And I just think that's a great quote, and it's great. You know, if you believe that, that says a lot about the future of sort of legal tech and legal ops more generally. So, yeah, so, you know, I don't have a strong view on where this fits in the market and whether there's enough demand for it, but I can certainly see that there may well be.
Well, I guess in my closed mind, I was thinking more about just corporate counsel, or I wasn't thinking about law firms. And obviously that totally makes sense. I mean, are law firms the right companies, or at least are they structured the right way to be able to navigate their way through this next phase of digitization? Probably not. I mean, in-house teams aren't, I would say. So setting up this function is going to be important. My question that I don't have an answer to is, like, who's going to train these people? Because there's no book on legal tech yet. You know, how to do this hasn't been written. And, you know, to what extent are they going to be bringing in resources or capability from other industries? Like, you spoke about, like, kind of IT backgrounds, maybe finance backgrounds that have gone through this digitization phase. So I wonder, these consultants, are they going to be people that are kind of trained brand new from university? Is there going to be like a specific qualification for this? I think that's really interesting. Or is it going to be kind of reutilized skills from different industries? I just would be really interested to see how the capabilities are built for that group. And I guess that's not just talking about HBR now. We're just talking about general legal tech consulting. I'm always generally interested to understand who are the people that are in this space? What are their backgrounds? Even what are their motivations? Is it to, you know, digitize and transform, or is it to move to managed legal services where you have a very kind of supply chain approach to a legal delivery of services? So yeah, anyway, I don't have an answer to that. It was more just, that's what I'm thinking about when I think about this.
Yeah, but I mean, just to add to that, I think, so certainly both of these organizations already do aim at the law firm market without a doubt. And in fact, the feeling I had from looking at their sort of websites and the article was that that's probably a larger focus than in-house, although, you know, I might be wrong there. But I think the, you know, private practice market is, you know, huge. So that's one thing. But secondly, I think, you know, you can think about this stuff and think about sort of technology and innovation, but you can also think about it as more sort of basic services, like, for example, you know, I have a law firm already and there's an entire infrastructure from a sort of operational process and technology perspective, which is not necessarily all that innovative, but it is necessary to run a law firm, like the things I mentioned, for example, your EA pool, your typing pools, your printers, your faxes, or not faxes anymore really, but printers, all that kind of grassroots stuff. And I think, but I suspect that the pitch here would be, hey, you're a law firm. What you do best is law. Let us take all that off your hands. And by the way, we can do it cheaper for you because firstly, those functions can be shared with other firms, so you don't have, you know, idle downtime there. And secondly, we can actually do it even cheaper because we can send it offshore for you. And I suspect something like that is the pitch. That's just my guess. But yeah, I suspect that's the pitch.
Yeah, no, interesting conversation.
All right, Microsoft, industry clouds, you want to set the scene for us?
Yeah, so I saw this and it has nothing really to do with legal, and I'll explain why, but Microsoft are making more industry clouds for more industry verticals. So what I mean by that is kind of creating out-of-the-box solutions for industry verticals like retail, for instance. They've redone retail, they've done healthcare, but they've just announced that they're going to go into financial services, manufacturing, and non-for-profit. So the idea is that they are pulling in all of their kind of technologies that they have and building in bespoke workflows, or at least bespoke solutions for those industries. So I thought, man, that's really interesting. When are they going to crack into legal? Why aren't they cracking into legal? And I think this links to an awesome conversation that we had with Mary, you know, just one episode ago, actually, about kind of point solutions versus enterprise tech. And, you know, we talked a lot about the benefits of going to a more holistic solution versus a point solution, because you have less systems to manage, less systems to train people on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So now that I'm seeing Microsoft go into these kind of industry vertical clouds, yeah, it just raises the question about, well, why not legal tech? And then I'm thinking, is this the domino for kind of large software cloud providers like Amazon, Google's to also lean into the legal tech space? And I think if Microsoft are doing it, they've obviously seen some kind of potential opportunity, you know, a bunch of users. So I assume that Amazon and other big companies like that are also thinking. So then, you know, I saw that they're currently they're in the planning phase at the moment to determine other verticals. Hopefully that means legal. I'm holding my breath there. But my question to you, Elliot, is like, what could this actually look like? If you're thinking about an industry vertical for legal that is built by Microsoft that kind of brings in all of their tools and maybe brings in some new tools specifically for legal, what could it look like? Now, I don't have an answer for this, but if you can just kind of sit back now and imagine, you know, lawyers use Outlook. And if you can think about Outlook as perhaps your kind of intake system, and maybe it's a little bit more sophisticated for legal, but it's maybe your intake system. And then you could use Teams for collaboration. So communications, meetings, those kinds of things. SharePoint for document management, knowledge management, and Planner for task management. The kind of list goes on and on and on. I mean, there's lots of technology that is built for kind of enterprise collaboration. And, you know, it raises the question of like, what is so specific about legal processes that would mean it needs to have bespoke technology? We talked about it quite a lot on this podcast. So yeah, what are you thinking? If Microsoft were to create a vertical, what would it look like from your perspective?
Yeah. Well, look, firstly, I think this is a fascinating approach by Microsoft, whether you're thinking about legal or not. And from what I could tell reading the article and also reading about it on Microsoft's in their website, what they're doing is sort of a couple of things. On the one hand, they're building sort of workflows and services on top of their existing product suite that they think will work for that vertical. So as you mentioned, like legal intake might be an example that they could build on top of their existing 0365 and related products. And secondly, I think they're building APIs that I assume will connect into some sort of non-Microsoft players that we know are already dominant in the relevant space. So to come back to the question, what could this look like? I mean, I sort of agree with what you said. Like, I think they could build various workflows and processes on top of their existing stack for things like intake and collaboration and document and knowledge management. Clearly, they've got all the kind of foundations to build that stuff on top of. I think the challenge for legal, I think there's sort of two main challenges, actually. One is that, and we've talked about this before and possibly with Mary as well. One is that in the legal market, I'm not sure that we have the kind of we've still got an immature space in legal, I think, because if I was to say to you, you know, what tool should I buy for legal intake, I'm not sure that we know yet which of the many options out there is the winner already. So there's no clear choice like there is in certain other industries for certain types of workflows. You know, we've said it before, but there are a bunch of them out there for different industries where you just know what the vendor is or what the tool is that is used. So I think for legal, we're sort of lacking that maturity in the technology space. So that's one thing. It would make it difficult to build those connectivity, those connectors, without knowing which products they should build the connectors for. So that's one sort of thing that I think could hold it back. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, and it kind of comes back to the point we just discussed in relation to the HBR Kinokozi merger, and that is the market big enough? Because I don't imagine that this is inexpensive for Microsoft, and that's both upfront and also to maintain going forward. And so is there actually a big enough market out there for Microsoft to justify putting the resource in to build these industry-focused verticals to begin with? And I don't know the answer to either of those questions, but I think those are the two big questions for me. But yeah, I think it'd be exciting, and it would be great to think as a legal ops professional that there's a whole bunch of kind of pre-baked stuff out there that I can be fairly confident is going to work for me. So yeah, I think it's an exciting time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was automatically thinking, okay, well, why would this fail then? If we're thinking about why, what could it look like, but why could it fail? And honestly, I really struggled to answer that question. I mean, the only obvious things are, you know, could a startup or another, you know, technology company that was a little bit more agile, be able to build something quicker, maybe. So it's just about kind of speed to market. But I think this is a long-term game. It's not just who's going to get there first, but it's who's going to, you know, build the best product and build the biggest customer base. Because, you know, think about some of these like Oracle or Salesforce. Like once you're on that as a company. you're not really going to change to something else. So getting those kind of really big juggernaut companies on board early on and keeping them, I think that's going to be the hard part as well. I was just automatically thinking about all the reasons why it would succeed. I mean, the biggest thing is brand loyalty. I mean, if Microsoft came out with a legal specific tool or at least said it's going to be for a legal industry, lots of people would buy it straight away.
Yeah.
It's just a really easy decision to make. You know, it's
a lot of people are probably already buying it.
Like,
this is Microsoft's killer sales tactic, right? You're already buying it.
You've already got it. Yeah, exactly right. That's so right. to just pay a little bit extra to get, you know, whatever it is, intake or extra workflows they're building on top of their current solutions, then yeah, it's easy. You don't have to go through the security requirements. You already know that it's a vetted company, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So
yeah,
I think brand loyalty and just ease to implement is going to be one of the key success factors, but also just minimal change management. I mean, if you can just think an augmented Outlook, I mean, that's awesome. People understand how Outlook works and their task works and Outlooks and how emails come in. But if you can just slightly augment that slightly and maybe slowly over time, I think you're going to see some real adoption as opposed to asking your legal team to put all their matters into a separate SaaS product that has separate separate fields and whatever it may be. And even though those products probably connect to Outlook to some extent, there is still an element of having multiple applications opened up on lots of different screens. We talked about messaging fragmentation. So anyway, I think that's going to be one of the other success factors, scale as well. Obviously, they can invest a lot of money into building this kind of solution, right? So they can, you know, they've got a bit of runway, I think, to build something really interesting. But also, the more people they can get on board, the more customers they already have on board, the better the solution is going to get. And then I think about, you know, some of these startup companies that may get maybe one or two, three big clients. I mean, they're learning from those customers every day. But if Microsoft are bringing on, you know, 2% of their, you know, their customer base, then that's a boatload of users, right? And they're learning so much about their products. So I think their ability to build and scale quickly is going to be above and beyond anyone, I think. And then the last point is the infrastructure is probably already built. I mean, if you and I try to create something to take on these, you know, Microsoft, you know, we would spend years just creating the infrastructure to support some of the simple stuff that Microsoft have. They've already got it. They've got the support teams. They've got the structure already for workflow management stuff. So anyway, there's a lot of points why I think it would succeed. But interesting thought for the listeners. I don't know. What do you guys think? Why would it fail? Why would it succeed? I just think it's a really interesting point to think about Microsoft. Maybe not even just Microsoft, but Amazon, Google's and those companies.
Yeah, look, I haven't got much to add to that. More Microsoft news. Let's move on to another point, more Microsoft news. Yeah. So more updates to Microsoft Teams. Mm-hmm. And so Microsoft Teams has a bunch of new features that are coming out this week, I think it is, or maybe they're already out now. So I'll just run through them quickly, Alex, and I'll pass over to you to comment. So they've got and I think it's all about presenting, essentially. So they've got a reporter mode where you as the presenter appear as like a little image in the bottom right-hand corner, I think it is, and your content sort of appears above your shoulder. And they've got something called standout mode, which is sort of similar, but you're a bit bigger and you're sort of floating above the content. And then they've got something called side-by-side mode, which is where you appear with your background. The other ones, I think they use their existing tech to hide your background, but with side-by-side mode, yeah, people can see your background or a virtual background and you appear on one side of the screen and your content's on the other side of the screen. So they're just bringing in these alternate ways for you to appear along with your content. And then the other thing they're doing is something called PowerPoint Live, which essentially allows presenters to see slides, notes, and chat all sort of in the one view, and allows participants to navigate the slides themselves. Mm. So yeah, a few different views here, and I'll let you comment first, Alex, and I've got a few sort of thoughts on this too, but you go first.
Yeah, so I mean, this is just a build on from when they brought out their Together mode, which came out, and I was like, oh, that's a bit gimmicky. But then I was like, actually, that's really awesome to be able to see people in a much better format than kind of previously. You can just see how engaged people are and how to present better. And I started thinking about, well, why should we be thinking about this in kind of legal operations? And I think about what I do on a daily basis sometimes. It's a lot of workshops. It's a lot of engagements with stakeholders. And if you're able to do that more efficiently through being able to see, you know, like I said, their full avatar through the together mode, but also if they can be a little bit more engaged with things like the reporter mode, which is actually pretty cool because they can see you, they can see the slide, and it's not really disjointed. Because, I mean, everyone's been on a call where the PowerPoint's gone up and then the person presenting is like a really small little person. It's just really hard to see. So I just think it's just amazing to be able to engage, because we know, and we've talked about this a lot, change management is so important for really any initiative that you're running as part of legal operations. And change management means engaging with stakeholders. And in a virtual world, how do you do that more efficiently? I think it's using these kinds of tools. It allows you to run more efficient workshops and be able to engage with people. So I just think this is an awesome step forward in virtual engagement. I mean, what I'd love to see is kind of when we do go back into the offices, having like kind of full length TV screens where you have this kind of presenter mode. It feels like the person's like standing right in front of you. And like that tech exists right now. It's just the appetite to buy it. But I think what this kind of COVID world has helped us do is understand how we can work more internationally, even though we're virtual, thinking about how we can work more virtually. So anyway, that was a pretty long rant just to say that this is cool.
Yeah, look, I've just got a couple of points on that. So one is that I think the interesting point here is not the specific features that Microsoft is adding, but the fact that they're continuing to add features, right? So clearly, they are taking the build out of their virtual productivity tools very seriously. And I think that's great in a world where, you know, there's lots of remote working. That's not going to end after COVID has quote unquote ended. And also for Microsoft, lots of competition in this space, right? So it's good to see that competition is doing what it should and is driving product development. So that's good. To the point you just made about, you know, big screens and where this could go in the future. Look, just a little anecdote I'll tell is that when I returned to the office relatively recently, I was on a conference call with a bunch of people, both in the office with me and not in the office with me. And one thing I found quite strange was sitting there with a headset on and a microphone on and yet being physically next to a bunch of other people who are in the same meeting as me. And I think that when we all start returning to the office, I think that's going to be something that we're all going to need to deal with. How do we enable people who are not physically with us to join while we can all be comfortable with those people and the people who are physically with us in the same meeting? And something like what you described with a big screen where we could all be in the one room probably is the better solution than everyone sitting there at their desks in their own little virtual bubble when you know physically people are right next to you. So I don't sort of have a strong view on the likelihood of that being adopted because it's probably expensive, but yeah. I do agree with you that that would be a better solution than having everyone at their stations with headsets and microphones on. And I think that's going to grow tiresome pretty quickly.
Why can't we have the 3D projected versions of people? You've seen those where they have like, they recreate like live shows of performers, but in like a 3D thing with like the optics and stuff. Anyway, that would be cool. Like imagine that in an office where it looks like there's a 3D person kind of sitting in front of you. That'd be so, probably not even that futuristic.
Bring on VR meetings.
Whoa.
That's pretty way off. Yeah.
Whoa. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, that's a whole different podcast.
Yeah, geez.
All right. Look, final point for us to cover today is one NDA. You want to set the scene or should I?
Set it away.
Okay. So one NDA is an initiative to create what it sounds like. One NDA that is sort of pre-agreed by the market as having universal and standardized clauses. And the idea is to, you know, get to a point where we can all kind of stop negotiating these documents that we don't find particularly valuable, we don't particularly enjoy the work, and that our clients don't want to pay us to do. Yep. Right. And so it seems like a perfectly reasonable idea to me. Now, the idea here is that they want to get 100 lawyers, and I'm not sure if that's individuals or law firms, maybe they have individuals representing law firms, but they want to get 100 lawyers to reach consensus on the standard NDA format, and they want to have 1,000 companies formally adopting the one NDA standard by the end of 2021, so by the end of this year. And again, I've got a few thoughts, but Alex, you go first.
Well, I mean, it's super cool, but it's obviously not without its challenges. It just, if you can imagine trying to agree a single NDA, which is what companies are faced with right now, but times that by 100 lawyers or 100 law firms, that's going to be a very difficult conversation. Everyone has different drivers, different motivators, different precedents, all those kinds of things. So it's not impossible. And I'm an optimist. So I think that's, well, I think it should happen, definitely. But like I said, I don't think it's without its challenges. But I think what gets me more excited about just the idea of a one NDA is this whole idea of like kind of open source within the legal industry. Because I saw this as like, yeah, cool, we're going to have like one NDA. And if we can do that, that sounds really awesome. It's going to save a lot of time, a lot of efficiencies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then I started thinking, well, hang on, is this kind of us, as in legal us, dipping our toes into this open source market? I mean, for the tech people out there or coders out there, you think of GitHub, but for legal. Could there be a place where we're sharing NDA templates, other types of templates, other types of knowledge, you know, how to configure certain technologies, taxonomies, all those kinds of things? I think that was a really cool conversation. Well, thought that I had in my own head, but then it immediately went to, well, how can we expand this idea of open source material and legal? And I don't have an answer for it yet. So maybe I'm going to think about it and come back to it, a pulse in the future. But I'm now thinking, what else could be like open source? Because we think about automating the NDA, which the whole legal industry dined out on, what, 3-4 years ago. Now we think about what we can automate now. Well, okay, what can we open source in the next 3, 4, 5 years? And how do we kind of build towards that future? Because that sounds really exciting to me. Anyway, you have probably lots of points on specifically trying to reach a standard NDA, right?
Well, let me just come back to that. So just on the open source point, I think this is a step further than open source. I mean, open source, I think, is more along the lines of, here's this stuff we've already made, feel free to take it and, you know, use it for your own purposes, right? I think this is going a step beyond that and saying not only is this, you know, something that we can all use, but it's something that we'll all pre-agree that we will use.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, so we won't depart from this. And that's where the efficiency comes in. We kind of all pre-agree that this is the standard that we'll use. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think the open source point is a great point, but I think this is a step even further than that, as I said. Mm-hmm. Maybe the open source point is what sort of comes first. I don't know. But just in terms of this specific idea, so look, I've actually been involved in something a bit like this, and I think I've mentioned this before on the podcast. So in Europe, there's something called the Loan Market Association, which is a group that represents market participants in Europe, and they produce standardized contract suites for loans and other related kind of financial products in the market over there. And the idea, and they, by the way, they have an NDA in that suite. And so in Europe, if you're in the kind of financial services space and you're doing a loan and you see and what's called an LMA standard NDA, it actually does make the negotiation much easier, and sometimes you can avoid negotiation altogether. So to some extent, on the one hand, this kind of already exists in a more limited way. And in relation to the loan documentation itself, those are very complex agreements. And what they're not is sort of documents that all participants say that they will not depart from. They're not that. What they are is a starting point for negotiation. And I don't have a strong view on whether this NDA project will get to that point or not. But I do think the industry has been successful in reducing the negotiation on even more complex agreements than this. So I think there's some good precedent for this. Having a look on the website for this project, I suppose I'll say a couple of things. They've got a detailed timeline, and we'll put a link either to the website in general or specifically to the timeline in the show notes. And they want to have, they're assembling the group that will comment on the provisions right now. And they want to have all that done, plus identification of the areas where there'll be departure from the standard provisions. They want to have it done in a couple of months, I think. And then I think they're leaving something like sort of July or June and July through to December to take it out to the market and get the 1,000 companies to adopt it. And so just a couple of things. I think it's a great example of some legal project management there, actually. They've got the timeline quite nicely set out. So yeah, it's worth looking at just from that perspective. But also it's really aggressive, right? So I think to try to have this done with 1,000 companies on board by the end of December, it's pretty aggressive. But look, you know, I am a lawyer who does not enjoy negotiating NDAs. So I wish them luck, and yeah, hope it all works. I hope to see a one NDA being used, you know, in the not too distant future.
I wonder if they're doing any work to like quantify the value of this work. Like, I know it's, I think it's a non-for-profit, right? It's basically just an industry consortium to basically get a mutual benefit. But I wonder if they're doing any kind of work to understand like what the value of this is. Like, if you take X hours saved from X number of firms and then times that by how much a client would pay, like, I wonder if there's a dollar value you can put on this. And if not, you know, if anyone from that group is listening to this, maybe have a think about that, because I think that would just be ridiculously powerful to have as a domino to a whole range of things like this.
Great point, Alex. Mm. Thinking like a legal arts professional. And I mean, but in all seriousness, I mean, that is a reason to go out and try to get funding from industry participants, right? Because everyone's going to benefit from this. Yeah. Anyway, Alex, good to chat as always.
Yep.
Talk to you next time.
Cheers, mate. Bye.